Hello and welcome back to Box Set Binge, the Bible from Seven Vineyard. My name is Bern Leckie and I'm joined today by Owen Lynch.
Hi Bern, and hello everyone. And I just want to say thank you to those of you that have given us some feedback on this podcast. And thanks so much for your encouragement, first of all, and also just the sense that you are listening to this. We really appreciate it. So if you're getting something out of it or any ideas, please do let us know. Bern and I would love to know what you're thinking.
I've really enjoyed conversations with people who have found something about the Bible that they maybe hadn't expected. And maybe they've found it through listening to us natter about it. But I think mainly people have found it just by listening and making the space to listen through the Bible and let it speak to you, rather than going into study mode with a book and feeling like it's like it's a chore or something to plow through. I think there's something very refreshing about hearing it, and very refreshing about going through at a pace that we don't get bogged down, but we do notice what grabs our attention. That leads us into what we've been looking at this week, because there's been a ton of things that have grabbed my attention, and not always in a comfortable way, at the beginning of Numbers. How have you found it, Owen?
Yeah, I've really not enjoyed it, actually. I've not enjoyed listening to Numbers. Is that all right to say that?
It's fine, yeah.
One, there's just a lot of data in there, and no one likes listening to data. Do you know what I mean?
It's like a spreadsheet. The podcast.
It is exactly like it's like someone reading out a spreadsheet. And the second thing is that the story's just deeply disturbing and unpleasant. Lots of bad stuff going on, which kind of isn't very life-giving, really, is it? How did you find it?
It is hard to know what to make of it. And some things did stand out that kind of didn't fit together. In a weird way, now we're recording this in a week when also, very weirdly, the biggest news story in the world seems to be about the Princess of Wales and her beautiful family released a beautiful photo of themselves, all the kids looking at the camera. Amazing. How on earth did she manage that? Well, it turns out she managed it the same way we all manage it, yeah. Which is using your phone and an app on your phone probably to just stitch the best bits together. And and if you look very carefully, and you had to look incredibly carefully, you could see a little bit of where it got stitched together and it didn't quite go together right. But that's not really the point.
I know.
But what's that got to do with Numbers? You would be right to ask.
Yes.
Let me tell you. I think what we've got in Numbers is a patchwork. We've got different bits stitched together for different purposes. Now, before you go mad and go, but no, surely it all has to be, this is a history bit, this is all has to be accurate and literally true, right? I'm not sure that was the purpose. I'm not sure that's how people in the ancient Near East would have read it. I'm not sure that that's what they needed for it. No one had watched a documentary and ever seen what a video camera would faithfully record of something. But while we're thinking about imagery, let's walk this through. Think about Israel that was going to move through the desert, right? Get a picture of that in your mind. Just a picture. Can you see it? Can you see the encampments? Can you maybe make your mental camera kind of rise up a bit so you can just see how big it is? Get an estimate of how many people you think that is in the camp, right? Don't look at the Bible to tell you how many. Just what's your instinct? What are you thinking now? And how many people are you seeing in that camp?
Yeah, I'm seeing a couple of million at least, I would have thought, but that's just...
Really? Oh, mate, you're a biblically steeped person.
I don't know.
Other people have asked for this, say, like, oh, maybe, I don't know, 20,000, 50,000, 100,000. You know, and that's what I thought of, like it's a Glastonbury, like it's a big old camping festival, like the biggest one you can imagine. But I mean, you're right, because the numbers that are added up at the beginning of Numbers come to 600,000 for the men of fighting age, right? That's a huge city. Now, that's only the men, so let's add in as many women, and so you're going to come to 1.2 million. That's Birmingham, okay? Well, you haven't got a small encampment moving around. You've got Birmingham moving around. Now, that isn't included the kids or the people past retirement age. Retirement age is also a thing that comes up in numbers. So you're right. I think that probably brings it closer to two and a bit million. So it's not Birmingham, it's the West Midlands. It's Birmingham and Wolverhampton and Coventry, all on this jaunt through the desert. And that's a bigger number than I expected. But who cares about what I expected? It's also a bigger number than the Bible seems to describe as Israel being this small nation, these people that were too small to make a difference in their area. My goodness, if they had an army of 600,000, they could have stomped over Egypt, let alone taken a little territory that we know how big it was. And we know what they could have done with a big army. But the Bible makes a point that they had to take time. And they were afraid of moving forwards and all that sort of thing. So at the one hand, you've got big Israel. On the other hand, you've got little Israel. Which is it? Well, these, to me, look like two different pictures taken for two different purposes, right? From two different angles. One's telling the story of how fruitful and how blessed they were because their numbers were blessed. And another's telling the story about what a difficult time they were having. One place where you can really see the join, if you're paying attention in Numbers 2 and 3, is how many firstborns were there? Like in each family, how many people were the firstborn male? Well, it says it's about 20,000. Okay, 600,000 people, 20,000 firstborns. That means, what, 30 boys in each family then? So add girls in, you're basically saying every woman in Israel was popping out 60 kids in their lifetime.
We just know that's patently not the case.
I think, to be honest, the fact that that hasn't been flagged by theologians more prominently in the past probably says something about how few women have been prominent theologians,
right, exactly,
in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, Why did we not notice this? And there isn't a single story I could find anywhere in the Bible where someone is noted for their 60 kids. Let me list you all of the kids that they had. So I don't think it's easy to just say, oh, well, you know, things were different back then, or God amazingly blessed them like this. No, it's just these are different stories told from different angles for different purposes. They've been stitched together into this patchwork of numbers, and when we look at the joins, we see things that don't make sense. So I think that can't be the point. I think the point must be, let's look at the individual bits and try and discern what the purpose is, as rather than necessarily taking everything super literally. Does that make sense then?
Absolutely, Ben. And I would suggest, and we'd be open to challenge on this, but I would suggest that no historian would seriously treat any of these books that we're reading as actual history. They would treat it as a history of sorts, but they wouldn't treat it as an actual history. But even then, an actual history is always viewed through the eyes of the person observing it and reporting it. So for instance, whenever you watch the news and watch a correspondent, they are giving you the version of history that they have observed from their perspective with their bias. And indeed, what we're reading here in Numbers that we know has been prepared, compiled, probably around the time of the exile in Babylon, about 500 years before Jesus, let's say, and also would have been tweaked and changed and passed from generation to generation. So what we here have is a story, if you like, of the relationship between Israel and Yahweh. And I think if you were to put a title across the whole book, you'd probably say it's the story of Israel's waywardness or Israel's rebelliousness and God's faithfulness to them regardless. Mm. And I think that's really important because this is a theme that runs right through the Old Testament. And it's definitely something that the Jews believed about themselves. They recognized that they were generally, just like every population has its issues. I mean, you mentioned that. I was just thinking about when you said the population of West Midlands. I'm thinking, how many crimes are, you know, being committed today in the West Midlands? How many people are lives are in a mess in the West Midlands? How many people's relationships are breaking down in the West Midlands today? You know, like that's, if that's a population of people that are moving through this quite small space of desert, to be honest with you, then actually what we're talking about here is really the sort of the everyday life of the Israelites, as and probably the sort of stuff that they were dealing with even at their time in exile in Babylon. So, you know, the time this is being compiled, these people were in Babylon, and they're reflecting on their ancestors who also weren't actually living in the homeland. They were traveling towards it, and they're really repeating stories of God's faithfulness, Yahweh's faithfulness to the Israelites. And that's the point that they're trying to convey, I think. And we know this, and I tell you why we know this, Bern, because the prophets in Isaiah 63, Ezekiel 20, Jeremiah 7, they all retell this wilderness story, this story of the Israelites being guided by God through the wilderness. The poets of Israel all reflect on this. For instance, in Psalm 79, 95, and 106, and even the apostles, thinking of Paul, particularly in 1 Corinthians, and Hebrews, of course, talk about the faithfulness of Yahweh, even in spite of the rebelliousness and waywardness of Israel.
That's really important, yeah.
So I find that quite fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, really fascinating.
It's really important. So what are the ways, what are the things that stand out to us as signs of that faithfulness and signs of this thing sort of working well when it worked, shall we say? I'm looking first of all at the Levites, that there was a special people that God said, I want some specialness here. I want some special dedication here. And it wasn't for everybody, but the Levites stood this role as priests. They could be the people that you would come to in order to come to God. They would be the people that God would train and equip to lead worship and to offer sacrifices and to teach teachings and to lead music and celebrations, all of which we might sort of put into different departmental roles. Like we have a staff team at church, and you know, the different people lead different aspects of church life. But within the Levites, this was all. I love how sort of geographically in this picture that's drawn up of the camps, everyone with a similar role lives in their district. They live in a district surrounded by other people, either with the same role or a similar role or a neighbouring role. And so everyone's sort of grown up in this place where, I guess, wholeness and sharing and learning from each other and a culture of that must be a thing, right? Hmm. So I love that picture, yeah. that geographical picture and that practical picture of here's a way that all this learning about stuff can be put into practice. What else did you notice?
Yeah, I liked the two sections of travel, and so they've left the area of Mount Sinai, and you know, a people the size of the West Midlands population, let's say, are moving en masse. I mean, that's a massive logistical exercise. And you know what, Ben? Just anecdotally, I used to be in the Air Cadets, and I used to play in a military band. I used to play the bass drum, and I remember how I used to lead big parades through Manchester, through Deansgate in Manchester, and often the number of people involved in these military parades would stretch best part of a quarter of a mile, I think, and there'd be two or three bands playing. One group of people would move to the rhythm of the first band, and one group of people would move to the rhythm of the second band, and that every now and again we'd have to stop.
Yeah,
because if we didn't, we'd push up into the back of the other people. It was just like it wasn't complete rhythm, and so I imagine you know, this what we're reading here is this journey through the desert was not something that's easy to imagine, and nevertheless would have had, you know, ridiculous amount of challenge. And of course people complain, and
absolutely. Yeah.
Even Miriam and Aaron, who are Moses's contemporaries, they're his co-workers, you know, they're complaining and bad mouthing him. You know, it's like someone's got to be to blame. Yeah. it's just a mess.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think what impacts me is the sense that bad behavior has its consequences, but nevertheless they were still part of this community of people that had this special relationship with God, and there's no change in that, and there's no mention that, you know, they ceased to be part of that. And I think it's really important to recognize that, because as Christians we can sometimes superimpose more medieval ideas about sin and the way sin separates you from God and what the consequences of that are. But here I think it's important to recognize these people are still descendants of God, and what we're reading is, of course, other people reading meaning into what may have happened. So we're looking here at, you know, there was an earthquake and some people, you know, died. What was the meaning behind that? You know, often meaning is superimposed upon an event retrospectively. Other time, you know, the camp is invaded by poisonous snakes, and some people are bitten and they die. And once again, what's the meaning of that? You know, does this natural event that happened, did, you know, was there some meaning that we can apply to this? Because we all do this, don't we? We all kind of look for meaning in events that we can't explain.
I think that's very debatable. The picture I get from Numbers is that all of these stories have been told with some sort of purpose.
Definitely.
But the purposes overlap. The Numbers seems to me a bit like a patchwork, a bit like that photo of, here's a bit that happened, and here's a bit that happened, and here's a bit that happened, but there's some stitching that makes it look like it's kind of a bit odd to us.
Yes, good. Yeah, good metaphor, yeah.
Rather than focusing on the stitching, I think I want to focus on the purpose of the bits being included. Why did someone breathe meaning into a thing? And I don't think it's necessarily meaningless. I think it's because various aspects of their experience struck them as important to share.
Yeah.
So and some of them are really difficult. So the guy who goes through collecting wood on the Sabbath, and he's breaking the law, and that's a clear breach of the Sabbath law, okay? And it's one guy, but they make a point of including it in Numbers that he had to die. Oh my goodness, that sounds unbelievable. But I can see it, the purpose of it being to say how important the Sabbath was, and that there were real serious consequences for breaking it. The difficulty is then applying that and go, does that mean that's what we have to do then? You know, and the answer to that, as we've already talked about, is no, according to Jesus. No, don't pray for fire to rain down on sinners. No, and don't do this. In fact, this story is directly referenced, I think, in the Gospels, because Jesus himself goes on a jaunt on the Sabbath and collects some food, and they trot along eating it, and they're breaking the law in all sorts of ways. And so it must have been on people's minds that this story had been shared. Perhaps that was part of the purpose of sharing it, because God knew that later on you'd have to wrestle with this when you see Jesus doing something that looks like it's literally breaking the law. How come Jesus can still say, well, I'm not, you know, the law isn't going away? The answer, as far as I can tell, looking at Jesus, is that the purpose of the law was never to build a religion. The purpose of the law was to build relationships and faithfulness, so that we would understand that there are such things as special things, and we would also grow our sense of wisdom and where to apply whether it's a good idea or not to have some food on where it looks like we might literally be breaking the law. Jesus is putting that into practice. He's showing what God's really like in the flesh. I'm going to trust Jesus on that one. And I think thinking about how does Jesus fit into these stories makes them look more awkward in a way, because you think that looks really different from what I expect. But it also, I think, helps us understand not just the specialness of the Sabbath, but the specialness of the Christ, and why the Christ is really important, and the difference that knowing Jesus can make to bring all this stuff into some sort of order and some sort of sense. Does that help though?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's important, isn't it, that we recognise, and we said this in our previous podcast about Leviticus, that this is the application of wisdom. And the application of wisdom for good living, not just for individuals, but for families, communities, and whole nations. And this principle, I think, particularly that sometimes, well, every action has a consequence, right? And I think that, was it Newton that came up with that? Every action has an equal opposite reaction.
Yeah.
It was Newton, wasn't it?
Physical principle, yeah.
I think there's this general rule that the Jews believed, and they still do, and they did then, that they're part of God's family, and just by virtue of being born into the family, you know, you can't change that. And there was this deep sense of you can't change that. So whilst they understood that sort of, you know, criminal actions or just nasty behavior, you know, has consequences, they never ever imagined that it meant that the consequences were that they would be removed from God's family.
No, and although some of the punishment bits look really harsh,
they do.
That isn't the main part of the patchwork, I think, that stands out as the most vibrant part. There are other parts of the patchwork which are incredibly important, which is all these roots back to restitution, all these roots back to restore good relationship. So this whole principle of atonement,
yeah,
the whole idea that people do mess up, that the nation messes up, that people mess it up, that rather than instigating a cancel culture for that, mm-hmm. you know, mess up and you are unpersoned, you are unplatformed, you are out. God's heart was, you got to recognize that something happened that was messing up and it can be put right. Those are the two things. So it's different from saying, oh, there's no way you can mess up because everything's fine. And it's different from saying, if you mess up, the consequence is death. It's actually the way of life that God puts into this, which I think is the most important part of the whole thing. And the Levites play this important role in that. The Levites are so important. For one thing, God's made this statement by having Levites, a certain number of Levites that represent the firstborn of every family. God's saying, your lives effectively belong to me. And what I'm going to do with them, rather than take them and crush them out, I'm going to turn them into a source of life for you, right? So instead of you just having your own lives, you're going to have life from me through these people. What does life from God look like? It's this way of life where whatever's happened, however badly people have messed up, there are ways back. There are ways to be restored and forgiven. And that's not just saying sorry to God and having God forgive us. I think God's pointing to a way of life where people ought to be forgiving each other. Well, I find that really hard. I don't know about you, but you know, I find it easier to count on the idea that because I'm a believer, God will forgive me for anything I mess up. I find it a lot harder to live the, if someone messes me up, do I forgive them? Do I properly forgive them? That's hard, but I think that's the way of life that God wants to put into the hearts of his people. That's still true for us. And so with that in mind, although there's so much difficulty in Numbers, the most vibrant bits, the most important bits to me seem like the recognition that although there is messing up, there is also restitution and forgiveness is possible and we should do it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think my only spin on that would be that there's an unconditionality to God's identity and the identity of the Israelites. There's an unconditionality. They just are. If you're descended from the line of Abraham, then you just are. You can't change that. You can't change that part. It was almost like your DNA almost. It's just part of who you are. And of course, they were just, you know, there were terrible acts of criminality, but there were also acts of cultural vandalism, if you like, during these times that would have been dealt with very severely within the context of this community, just like there would be nowadays. You know, I mean, you could say that our penal system, our legal system, our justice system is quite harsh. You know, we lock people up for the rest of their lives if they commit terrible crimes. There are consequences to our actions, quite rightly. And of course, there are consequences to our actions. If, you know, if you just fall out with your neighbor, there's terrible consequences that can play out in our lives. And I think that what the Book of Numbers reminds us is that that's always been the case. It was then and it is now. And where I find this really interesting is because we've also been listening to Psalms 38-41. And David is widely regarded as as perhaps being the author of these Psalms. Whether he was or not, I don't know. But they certainly were written in the guise of being written by David, or these are the words of David. And what we know about David from the Bible, because we don't know him as an historical figure, what we know about what the Bible says about David is that David was a man after God's heart, let's say, you know, a man who loved God, loved Yahweh. But he was always, he just seems to behave in ways that are just antisocial, sociopathic almost at times, you know, having one of his soldiers murdered so that he can, you know, marry his wife, you know, just stuff like that. You know, you just go, yeah, that's terrible. But what one of the things I notice about David, and I think we see this in these Psalms, is that he's beside himself with guilt and shame at times. And then other times he's kind of like, yeah, but I'm righteous in God's eyes. I love it.
Yes. So I know what you mean. Like in Psalm 41 is really hard to make sense of from a kind of a logical point of view, because you're looking at David, it says, and he's suffering. He's clearly afflicted, but it's for all sorts of reasons at the beginning of the Psalm. It's because he sinned against God. Have mercy on me, God. Lord, heal me. And it's also because of his enemies. My enemies say of me, when will he die and his name perish? So everything's going wrong there. But by the end of Psalm 41, you've got this remarkable thing where he's saying to God, because of my integrity, you uphold me. Well, what's that about? You know, so at the beginning of Psalm 41, he's full of sin. And he can't, you know, and he's suffering because he can't approach God. And by the end of it, he's like, oh, no, but you uphold me because of my integrity. I think, again, this is a clue not to read this in the way that we tend to with modern mindsets and go, oh, there must be some logic here. And there must be some, you know, integrity must mean that he was sinless, or integrity must mean that he was you know, without blame for anything. I think you could use the word righteous in the sense that he had right relationship with God, because God just chose to have right relationship with him and put him in the right relationship. And maybe what helped him be in right relationship with God wasn't his sinlessness, but his trust, his faith, his willingness to come to God and be restored to a place of right relationship, and trusting God was the source of that, rather than trying to sort it all out on his own and then go to God saying, hey God, look what a great job I've done. And I think that's the difference, and I think that's where it really impacts me anyway, is so that I think that's more important to be able to go to God wholeheartedly and trust him and recognize that we don't really know the source of why everything's going wrong or why we're feeling rubbish or everything like that, but we can trust God for restoration. And crucially, Psalm 41, I think the window into this isn't just David thinking about himself. It's blessed are those who have regard for the weak. The Lord delivers them in times of trouble. David is coming to God wanting God's concerns for the whole of his community to be his concerns as well. So it's not a psalm about personal justification. It's a psalm about wanting God's love and protection and integrity and ability to restore to be accessible to everyone.
Yeah, and I think the other thing I'd add about that then is that I think that David was just someone who knew he was loved by God. Now, it may be that David was just well-loved. He was the youngest of his family, of course, and you're often the youngest are super confident, aren't they? But you know, there was a sense that he was part of a, you know, a fairly loving family. And the reality is, I think, is that, you know, I think David just grew up believing that God loved him and he was loved by God, and it, to some extent, some of his mistakes in life were just horrific. I mean, you know, he just did some terrible, terrible things, and of course we see the consequences of David's actions. We often hear that Solomon's lauded for, you know, being the wise king and the most, if you like, the most prolific king of Israel, but the reality is that actually his life was a mess. And Absalom, another of David's sons, his life was a mess. You know, so his family, his children, I think, suffered some of the consequences of David's actions. But nevertheless, I think David was still just, he just knew he was loved by God, and he would bring, no matter what disaster was going on in his life, he would always crawl his way back to God, going, "But I feel safe with you, God. I am secure, even though my life's falling apart around me. I'm such an idiot, but you're not, and I'm loved by you." I think there was a self-assurance, but it was a self-assurance that came from knowing he was loved by Yahweh. At least that's what it looks like, put it that way, to me. But I might be just reading some stuff into that just because of my own experience of life. But I do think that what we see in Numbers is this sense of God's faithful regardless of what you do. And what we see in these Psalms of David as well is that God's faithful regardless of what David does.
That's very important, yeah. And I think that connects for me in life generally as well. We recognise that as important at home. As we bring up a son, we've got two main things to do. These are our two things on the to-do list. One, for him to know how much he's loved. And it's only on the basis of that that he can do the second thing, which is to practice and get really good at loving other people.
That's it.
That's the curriculum. And that's, yeah, if he happens to be good at other things, it turns out he's good at maths, he's good at dancing, great. If he gets good grades, brilliant. If he finds a satisfying career, I think he should be able to, on the basis of having the stability of knowing that he's loved and knowing that he can be good at loving other people. I think those are the two things that I think anyone needs to be able to get through life. Those are our priorities. Now, does that mean that sometimes things are uncomfortable? Yeah, it does, because sometimes showing that we love other people means making sacrifices. Showing that we love other people means keeping our promises, for example, and saying no to something nice and new that comes along sometimes because we'd already promised someone else that we'd do something with them. That's an example that we have to put into practice ourselves. So there's a kind of a cost to it, but it all starts with knowing that we're loved, knowing how much we're loved. And we've also known as well that we can only demonstrate that to our son in part by our own example. The only way that our son can know how much he's loved is for him to know for himself who God is, and for him to know for himself and trust for himself that God loves him. And that's why we want him to be at church and to know Jesus and to know everything else that God's done through history, because we think it points in the direction of love and how he can know that he is fully loved. And how he can have a source of love which is bigger than we can supply for him, so that he can love others with that. I think that's the whole point of, you know, that's the whole point of life for God to have for us. What do you think?
I agree, Bern, and I share the same desire for my own children. And I do think that you know, what you're describing there is connecting our lives to the story of love, which is expressed through the Bible. And I do think that in spite of all the nasty stuff we see in Numbers, you know, the earthquakes, people dying, snakes, you know, vicious death, you know, what we see here is the love of God being faithful, and people who are living in the love of God despite the challenges and the horrors of life. I think that's a great story that the people, the Israelites who were writing this down in exile were trying to pass on to their children. And perhaps as a story of hope, because they indeed themselves were facing exile in a situation where they didn't want to be. They want to be back at home in Jerusalem, living in the land of milk and honey, so to speak. So, yeah, I think that's probably a great place to stop today. If we haven't already run out of time, what do you think, Ben?
Yeah, I think it's a good place to take a breath. We're going to sprint for the finish line of Numbers next week, which will also be the end of this big run through the beginning of the Torah. So we've gone from Genesis all the way through to Numbers. We're going to leave the fifth book till later in the year because it's kind of a recap and we're going to do that along with some other recaps of the story later. But next week, we finish Numbers, and then we're on to the Gospels when it's just about time for Easter as well.
Fantastic. We're looking forward to that. See you next week.
Bye.